Sportsnet and Sportsnet 590 The Fan present Point Taken, a podcast connecting you to the sports and pop culture issues you care about and the guests you want to hear more from. Now, here's Carolyn Cameron and Greg Brady.
Welcome to the August 8th week edition of Point Taken. Just Greg Brady from Brady and Price, Sportsnet starting lineup, 5:30 to 9. 3.5 hours a day isn't enough, and you know it, and I sort of know it. Carolyn is in Montreal, Quebec, and as we record this, she's on the television right now. I can't see her, but she's on duty for Rogers Cup coverage, as she should be. All is right in the world. Roger Federer is in the same city she's in. Just gets embarrassing. It's wonderful. Carolyn will be back next week. We have a very special guest this week. And why waste any time? There's an amazing column story about Madison Hollerin, who committed suicide. She went to University of Pennsylvania. She was a long distance runner, freshman at an Ivy League school, recruited to go run track there. I think by all accounts, beautiful, by all accounts, popular. She ended her own life. Why? How? It's a dynamically important book by Kate Fagan from ESPN, who you know from a lot of different branches of the worldwide sports leader. And we're very, very pleased to welcome Kate Fagan in to discuss the book and some other interesting items as well on the Point Taken podcast. We're very pleased on the Point Taken podcast right here on Sportsnet.ca to have Kate Fagan on from ESPN. You would know her work, of course, from a couple different fronts, certainly as a writer in the magazine, certainly on ESPN Radio. You hear her with Will and Kate. She does the trifecta with Sarah Spain and Jane McManus as well, and regular appearances on Around the Horn. It only lists on her page how many times she's won, but everyone's a winner on Around the Horn if you've seen the show. Kate Fagan joins us now with a brand new book out. Called What Made Maddie Run, The Secret Struggles and Tragic Death of an All-American Teen. It's great for you to come on, and ESPN's that odd entity. I lived in the States for 9 years, and so I know the network, I know the personalities, but Canada, it's this, we get ESPN programming from time to time, but when I mentioned to a few people here in Toronto, I mean, it's the biggest city in Canada, that you were going to be able to come on, they were super excited, and they knew all about you, and that Canada's that different entity for people on ESPN, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, I covered the 2015 Women's World Cup, so I was in a bunch of different Canadian cities, and I was always perplexed at like which programming everyone got from ESPN. It was like some places got First Take and Around the Horn, and then other places it felt like it was just all TSN. So in the States, it's like this all-encompassing entity, right? Like you consume it mobily, digitally. We try to be everywhere, and then I know in Canada, slightly different, but I guess that's the extent of my expertise on that subject.
Yeah, I go into hotels in the States, and they lob all the ESPN channels right on top of each other. So you hit like an ESPN wall before you get to like NFL Network and other stuff when you're actually looking for stuff that isn't local news or you're able to buy like a blender or something like that. That's how it works.
Yep.
Now, a few of us, also me included, saw you on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. That's a difficult, you're engaged in a really important subject, a sensitive subject that you wrote an article about and then a book. And Trevor is genuinely hilarious, but also a deep thinker. It's difficult to do those kind of appearances sometimes because it's, like I said, it's a serious subject. And yet you're with a guy who's very, very gregarious and outgoing, aren't you?
Yeah, and I was actually more nervous for that than anything I'd done in a while simply because of the reasons that you listed. Like, it felt like a balancing act between trying to be, like, outgoing enough to keep people's attention but not spoil the subject matter by trying to bring too much levity to it. But I was put at ease when, like, the producer called me the morning of, and we walked through the certain topics and questions, and then she called back like 3 minutes later and she was like, just FYI, don't try to be funny. And I was like, okay, good. We got that out of the way. Like, I'm not going to try and do anything except like be engaging and try and convey the information about what's in this book.
The book is your second book. The first book was very much about yourself and your college basketball experience. Is it a fair question to ask which book was sort of tougher to write? Which book was sort of more of the emotional grind, because here you are and people know you, and you're leading a career that probably, you know, is the envy of many. We're all lucky to do what we do, and yet you wrote the second mm-hmm. book about such a tragic story of a younger girl.
Yeah, I mean, this second book was by far the more challenging book to write, because it tells the story of Madison Hollerin, who died by suicide during her freshman year at running track and field at UPenn, so an Ivy League school in the States. And my first book being more memoirish and slightly comedic, you know, it was about me coming out on a college basketball team of fundamentalist Christians, so there's some humor in there. And it was also a story that I had processed. So it had happened 10-plus years ago. It was kind of almost like I was telling the story of something that had happened to someone else. Whereas with Madison's story, like, I was being journalistic. I was trying to get to the bottom of questions. I was really exploring, in a lot of ways, emotions and issues that I myself wasn't totally sure how they impacted me. Because I think a lot of us, especially athletes, we've had struggles at various points in our careers, especially during that transition to college. And maybe you didn't name it, or you hadn't really remembered what that felt like. And I think Madison's story and the writing of it really opened my eyes to a lot of issues that are affecting young people. And it was hard hearing from so many young people, absorbing so many of their stories. And so for that reason alone, it was a bit of a shadow, but I tried to move it out of the shadows and into the light, and the light being more of a conversation around this. And let's talk to parents. Like, let's make sure what happened to Maddie is something that, because it is avoidable, that we can avoid in as many young people as possible.
How did the, tell us how the article morphed into the concept of a book? Because I remember reading the story, in your words. When did you say this? We can go even deeper, because some articles don't work that way. Some, talking to some authors, it's
right.
this is what it can be. It's sort of like you know, movie to mini series or something. The whole story got told. When did you realize there were a lot more layers that you wanted to explore here?
I knew right away. Simply, well, as most writers, right, I turned in a draft of like 8,000 words or something, you know, and the magazine graciously gave me something like, you know, 3,200. So right from the beginning, I had a lot more to say. But of course, some writers, it's just you're being verbose, and there was plenty of fat to cut anyway. Certainly that was true to some degree, but I really felt like there were key components of Maddie's story, not the logistical X's and O's of her story, but really the meaning behind her story that we lost in the magazine article. But really, the driving reason was that I got hundreds of emails from students, high school and college, some parents who were like, I forwarded this article to my parents and we started a conversation. And most of those emails would include something like, here's the one part I want to know more about, or like, or one like layered topic within it. Not like something about Maddie, but like, I want to know more about your thoughts on like social media and how that impacted. So it was really in the 3 months after that magazine article where we looked at all of the emails we got and all the feedback we gotten, and there were so many people asking more questions that I wanted to answer those questions. And that was when we kind of moved forward on saying, like, let's expand this and try and bring this story to like a more robust, not really conclusion, but place, because there is no conclusion.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned social media for younger people, and it's something that we all kick around and we all talk about. And without talking to the younger people themselves, the people in their teens, I think what we all say, you say it, I say it, our contemporaries probably say it, oh boy, I would have gotten in so much trouble then, I wouldn't have known how to handle it. And it's a really tricky game. A lot of that is true, and yet a bad day used to be for us in high school, you know, was it, or to me, like getting kicked out of a tennis practice for slamming a racket, or a C on a paper that you thought you should have got an A on. But these things, they are, you know, there's huge mood swings from what I remember of that age as a teenager, and I still can't imagine social media playing a role in it and being judged. We're all worried about the judging thing from our peers and maybe even those authority figures when we're coming into those 15 to 22, let's say, those formative years.
Yeah, and I think the point about social media, I think it's really easy to just get caught up in like, oh, well, look, we're all editing ourselves. And I think historically we've always edited what we put out to the world. And right now it's about the consumption of other people's edited lives and how much of it young people are consuming. That's a distinct point. And like you mentioned, we hear all the time, like, imagine if, you know, Michael Jordan had social media. That's part of the issue is what we, the part of the issue being, like, what kids are allowed to convey about themselves. Like, it is so much deeper than that. Like, there is, when you look at the studies and some of the research that's finally being done, like, there's an issue with kids being unable to, like, self-soothe is, like, the best way to put it. Adapt. Like, there's just so much, like, lifestyle optimization that social media and technology is offering young people. Like, they want instantaneous access to the best things, to responses, like, there's just this endless amount of distraction, and as they're growing up, like, that's what life is like for them. And then when they get to that first transition or hurdle, and in Madison's case, and for a lot of young people, that big first transition is college, where your foundation has shifted, and a lot of them are not able to overcome, like, the feelings of being alone and loneliness and trying to navigate a new place, like, because we haven't allowed our kids to do that, because there's been so much has been accessible to them, and there's been so much sort of just vigilant, you know, helicoptering. Mm-hmm. And so the social media aspect is not like just what they put on one Instagram or tweet, but it's like this fundamental shift in like how they like live in the world and process the world.
And yet, you know, I think there's a point where, and maybe it's just everybody, we already know everybody is different, Kate, but I think you've covered sports on the road before, so have I. You can come back to your hotel at 10 o'clock at night, and I've often said to myself on a given day, if I'm on the road at a hockey series, NHL playoff series for 5 days, you know, I'm not sure I spoke to anyone today except interviewing players at practice and maybe getting dinner somewhere or the room service guy. And yet I crave that sometimes. The isolation is, it shuts all the other noise out. It doesn't work that way for everybody, and it doesn't work that some people just don't do well being alone. Others do.
I mean, I think there's a great new book out called, like Leadership in Solidarity, which is trying to make the point that you find who you are in the silence, and you have to solidify who you are in the silence. And that doesn't mean that, you know, people are extroverts or introverts and people enjoy that more than others. But I think there's something to be said for being able to, like, process who you are and be okay with who you are without outside validation. I think that's more the key point here when it comes to young people. There's the point simply of growing up and playing. I think you and I probably both grew up and played outside, you know, like, played some capture the flag, played pickup basketball, like, ran around with neighborhood kids, and, like, sometimes you got knocked down. Sometimes you got made fun of, and you had to figure it out internally for yourself how you're going to process those things. That's happening less and less for kids these days. I think that's a key point. And then another key point is kids get to college and, like, so much validation has been through means that are external that they really have very little control over, like how many likes they get, mm-hmm. how people react to what they do, as opposed to really being, and this is not all kids, right? Like, this is not, it's not a generational issue. I think I can even look at, I mean, I've spent the last 48 hours basically living inside my phone. When I look out into the world right now, I feel like the world is like the Truman Show. It's like sort of like screen, you know? So this is not just a young people problem. It's certainly seeping into the brains of older people, but trying to disengage from the validation being something outside of our control and really learning what you're passionate about. And in Madison's case, what she was passionate about, there was a mix-up in a lot of ways between this pursuit of running an Ivy League and maybe what really drove her inside.
It's the book's called What Made Maddie Run, The Secret Struggles and Tragic Death of an All-American Teen. ESPN's Kate Fagan is our guest. Let me ask you about the concept of that, of sort of conflict resolution. I have an 11-year-old boy and a 9-year-old boy. What I remember is a lot of days in elementary school where it was sort of like, it was like the movie My Bodyguard. You're trying to avoid the bully. You're trying to, you know, watch your P's and Q's with the bigger, older kids who could push you down in a hurry. But I did find, I weirdly found, I mean, kids now are like, hands off, don't touch each other, don't do anything. And I am often found, and maybe this is, you might think this is a guy thing, but I found you'd have a fight with a kid, like you'd draw up against each other, and you'd never have a problem after that. And I don't think that's the solution. I generally don't, but you certainly isn't for adults or even in high school. But I want to make sure that kids today have this ability to resolve conflicts. And when I hear about some of the bullying problems online, and I hear about a lot of the stuff through Facebook, through social media, with that terrible story with the young boy who committed suicide because his girlfriend asked him to, and she's just been sentenced. I think, well, none of this stuff was prominent. I don't, 25 years ago, there were just different ways to sort things. And so, yeah, I'm sort of banging. I'm like the old guy on the porch banging on how bad technology is. And yet you're writing this, and it's obvious we've got some of the means to help. We talk about these conversations more than we ever used to. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, and you're spot on about like the playground, and certainly nobody's advocating for, you know, bullying or physical confrontations. It's more of a general sense of like, when I grew up, I remember playing in a way that there was no adult supervision, and that was really healthy. Sometimes I came home crying and I like scraped my knee, but I had to get home myself, and I had to then go back out and play with those kids and resolve my own like space in the world on my own, as opposed to having it, you know, cone set out by adults. And so if we're talking about sports, like that's how I grew up, was like figuring out my place on the pecking order and trying to get hired, you know, by like getting better and staying present. And that's happening less and less. And like, you know, smart people in the world would call that free play. Mm-hmm. And then like the social media aspect, there will be a bunch of studies coming out. There's a new book coming out. They ran a sample of it on The Atlantic about technology and social media and how in so many ways it's corrupting young people and their ability to like communicate in person. And it's a scary thing to communicate with somebody in person, because you might say the wrong thing. You know, you can't, on text, it's really hard to say the wrong thing because you can edit as you go. But in person, like meeting a new person is challenging, but also rewarding, and young people are doing it less and less. And like, that's where the compassion lies. That's where, you know, your connection with other people lies, which allows you to like become a fully formed human and be happy in the world. So there's a lot of different issues at play here. And then, you know, the baseline that I also try and point out is like, a lot of it is mental health as well. When it came to Madison's story, there's that fundamental anxiety and depression that she was dealing with, but the frightening thing is that more and more kids are dealing with anxiety and depression because of a lot of these issues.
I'd ask if you think, from your research, does it ever swing the other way? Not that we're over prescribing or over diagnosing, but could a parent say, my kid, I know I went through, like I said, ups and downs. You know, sometimes you feel picked on, sometimes you don't feel like you fit. That's a natural thing about being young. It's not great, but I wouldn't have wanted my parents to say, we were really worried. We got a depressed kid. I'm like, I just went through a sad few days. Are parents so overly into their kids' lives, and they should be concerned, friends should be concerned, that is there ever a danger, I'd ask, that we are looking, it's like the boy who cried wolf. Are we looking for something where it's just like, you gotta ride this out. You don't need medication. You don't need a psychiatrist. You just, you know, these are normal evolutionary things that happen when you're younger.
Some of it absolutely is simply that, like, when you look at the rates of anxiety and depression that are rising among, like, high school and college-age students, some of it is simply just a change in culture that, like, more kids are probably willing to say that out loud than ever were before. And so not all of it can be ascribed to, like, true fundamental shifts in the brains of young people. But I think what the difference is, like, it's, and I'm not a professional, so I'm not here to say, like, who needs drugs and who doesn't. Actually just having the resources available, the professionals on college campuses who do know that distinction and know it really well, because you can't, it's not simply like, hey, we have more anxiety, which seems like a nebulous concept. Like, kids are dying by suicide at a higher rate in college. And it's hard to just chalk that up to like momentary, and it can be momentary, but something's going on, and I'm not smart enough or, like, studied enough to, like, pinpoint exactly what it is or the causality. I just know a lot of the studies that have been done around the issues, but certainly having the resources on college campuses and in athletic departments with the professionals who can distinguish between, hey, you just need to come in and see someone and talk a few times, and, like, we'll get you back on track, versus, like, this is a very serious issue. We need to make sure we have those people in place.
Like I said, you're branched out into podcasting. You began as a writer, covering the Philadelphia 76ers, doing a couple other things in the business after playing college basketball. What is, I was thinking about that when you mentioned the edit button, when I've done sports radio for about 20 years, and you realize you get into trouble from time to time, and your excuse, maybe it's more an explanation, is, well, there's no delete button. But there's a dump button, but there's not a delete button. When you've done your podcast, when you've done Around the Horn, do you sort of have that ability to edit on the fly? Everybody's got moments where they're like, oh my gosh, every show, every 3.5 hour show, I'm like, I can't believe I said those two things. That was dumb. And as long as they weren't offensive or something, you know, that's not going to haunt you for the rest of the day. And you do have those days, very few and far between. What is the broadcasting element like for you of journalism compared to writing, where you can really... You really have room to stretch out and edit and be flexible.
Yeah. Well, actually, I mean, I don't know if this answers your question, but here's what I was thinking of when you were talking, was I do a lot of shows on ESPN that are live. Like, Outside the Lines, I back up Bob Lee, and it's live. And when I filled in on First Take, we're live. And those shows don't cause me that much anxiety, because I just know I'm in the moment. If I mess up, like, a thought, when trying to get to the end of the sentence and hopefully at some point convey an idea. Around the Horn is taped, and it causes me so much anxiety, because I have this concept in my mind that I should be perfect, because if I'm not perfect, let's bust out of the segment and let's redo it. And it's almost like a performance. And I guess the way I'm relating that to, like, Madison and social media and kids these days is, like, so much of everything that they're putting out there is edited, where, like, they must think that they have to, it has to look perfect and be perfect because you can change it. As opposed to 30 years ago, it's like most of what you did was live. You know, most of the time you engaged with people, you had no, you know, net underneath you. You were on the high wire, whether you're meeting somebody for coffee for the first time, and you just got to be your best self and get through it, or your worst self if that's what you want to be. But it didn't come with the anxiety of this expectation that I can edit it, therefore it should be perfect. And I think that it's possible that, like, young people, and even in me, on my Instagram or on my Twitter, I get the sense that everything has to be ideal, because it can be edited, and I can delete it, and I can put it up. So, like, there shouldn't be any mistakes, and you're not allowed to be human, and that causes us a lot of anxiety.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think that's changing with the concept of the podcast, where there's no commercial coming up. There's no, you know, awkward transition you got to make to another topic if you don't want to. And it can sound a little more, everybody, it feels like, is doing them, so it can feel a little more free-flowing. I noticed that is somewhat different. Let me ask you about sports radio. I'll see on Deadspin or Awful Announcing, somebody that does something naturally on another station, and I'm like, oh God, that's not good for the industry, or they get suspended, or they end up getting fired over something terrible, and I'm going, that makes the rest of us look bad. Do you look and say, with sports radio, there are, because I would guess you wouldn't do every appearance if there's a show or a station and you're like, geez, I don't know if that's what I want to be part of, because some of them are different than others. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I sports radio, I mean, I grew up in New York, so grew up listening to The Fan, you know, Mike and the Mad Dog. I'm not as well versed in, like, I've come to learn about sports radio and how there can be people trafficking in outrage and saying outrageous things, because that's what gets attention. But it's never been my world, because at least at ESPN radio, like, we do this weekend show, we try and cover more in-depth topics, and so it's not quite anything I've had to venture into, because I've never really lived in that world.
I wonder, I mean, we've gotten asked before about women in sports radio. And I've taught people, I've taught classes of younger kids. And it always, when I talk to women, I think it would have great potential for sports radio. They always tell me that it's almost the last thing they want to do. And I can't tell, it's sort of chicken and egg. I can't tell if it's because there aren't as many as there should be. And I'd say that's true. And, or they're more interested in television, or they're more interested in writing, or they do want to get into play by play. I can never figure it out. And yet I worry that there aren't. I don't think we're as diverse as we should be. and yet, at the same time, right. you can't force people into it if in journalism or communications they have other preferences, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think it comes down to this, like what you've grown up hearing on sports radio. It's really a place, at least in my experience, where like the focus is on like quote unquote playing the hits and. That can be hard, you know, like it's like, okay, we're going to talk about Kyrie Irving, then we're going to talk about the NFL, and there doesn't seem to be as much of a territory to, like, explore different topics in sports radio because it's such, like, because it worked, right? This is a formula that works. You talk about the three main stories, and you get passionate about them, and then you do it again at the top of the hour. And so I know when I was, like, on the outside looking in, there didn't, like, in podcasts there seemed to be, you know, more room to be like, look, I want to do a podcast that's a little bit off the beaten path, and that's okay because you're not being broadcast live and you're not like being sent out to a population that's used to one thing. And so there's a place in sports radio to like zag when everyone else is zigging or zig when everyone else is zagging, but it seemed like the Titanic trying to spin it around. And like even the radio show that we do on Saturdays, we try and just incorporate a couple of offbeat topics here and there, but like, you'll generally find us playing the hits as well because you can't just spin the boat around all at once. And I think that can be daunting for people looking in from the outside if, you know, if they want to talk about what they see as more like, you know, meaningful topics as opposed to like, you know, speculation about trade bait.
So given your basketball pedigree, I'm going to ask you about the psychology of free throws. I don't know if you still have the Big 12 conference record for consecutive free. Do you know if you do?
I don't.
Someone broke it.
Well, what happened was Colorado went to the Pac-12, and so we don't even know. Like the record is just in the abyss. So somebody broke it, but now it's the Pac-12 record.
It's the greatest game to play with somebody to ask them if who's in what conference these days. Like again, I grew up in I guess sort of Big Ten country, and the Maryland Terrapins and Rutgers will never be Big Ten schools to me. But that's where they are, and you know
it's
you get
yeah. And Nebraska's a Big Ten school.
And Nebraska.
Nebraska.
Yeah. Yeah, you needed that matchup in 1997 during Charles Woodson's Heisman year when they split the national title. But so I hear this Malcolm Gladwell podcast talking to Rick Barry about the underhanded free throws. Do you think when you watch and maybe you had this with some of your teammates? So when you see Andre Drummond and he's shooting 32%, or Ben Wallace, or even Shaq. Do you feel it psychological? Do you feel it's something that they just have given up on the practice of it, that it's all right between the ears? How do you view it?
I also listened to that revisionist history podcast. But luckily, I was a very, very good free throw shooter, so I never had to consider doing it underhand. And I feel like because my basketball career is like 10-plus years over, I can talk about myself as if I'm another person and praise myself. So you'll excuse that. I was a good free throw shooter, so I'd never had to consider underhand. I do feel like shooting has always been to me something that I know people are like, you can get better at it. Like when guys are coming into the NBA and like shooting is something like that's his weakness. Like, well, he can improve it. Certainly anything in this world you can improve through practice. But I've always leaned more toward shooting, and that includes free throw shooting, being something if like by the time you're 16, you don't have some sense of fluidity about your shot, free throw or otherwise, it's going to be hard to retroactively inject that fluidity into your shot. And so I kind of danced the line between, yes, Shaq and other guys, like they took 100 a day, like they could certainly go from like 55% or 45% free throw shooters to 60% free throw shooters, but it's never going to be smooth. It's one of those things that you have to do as you're like coming of age, in my opinion.
So, but that says, like you said, and I would say rather casually, I was a good free throw shooter, but was that there's always natural ability in athletes, but there's practice. If I said I was a good tennis player, that was hundreds, thousands of balls hit against the back of my parents' house, right? Like, it just didn't happen overnight. You must have practiced it tons and tons of times, but you're saying by a certain point, if you haven't put the practice in, it's awfully hard to catch up.
Yeah, I guess absolutely. I had my dad play professionally overseas, and he's a fantastic shooter. And so I put in the 10,000 hours, and I put in the 10,000 hours with the correct form, mm-hmm. which sometimes you have one or the other. When you have both, you obviously end up being like a really great shooter. What I'm saying is, like, if you're somebody like Shaq and you grow up and you don't start playing till high school, and then like your game is low post and your game is not necessarily the fluidity of your shot, you can then put in all the hours you want after the age of 18, and you can shoot 100 free throws a day after practice. I don't think you're ever going to be able to, even with that, once you're a full-grown human, I think it's really hard to become a shooter after you've already, like, you have your mechanics and you've grown up with certain mechanics. Like, I think it's really hard to then put in the hours after you've already become a fully formed basketball player. I think you can get better.
Yeah.
I don't think, no matter how many hours Shaq put in from the age of, like, 19 to 30, I don't think he was ever going to be able to be, like, a 75%, 80% free throw shooter.
You've devastated Andre Drummond's trade value during this podcast. For Stan Van Gundy, he will not be pleased. One more on the book, What Made Maddie Run, The Secret Struggles and Tragic Death of an All-American Teen, Kate Fagan, our guest. You're doing a bit of a tour for this. You're going to some places and you're doing some speaking and some reading. Are you expecting, because I know the book's been out about a week, the conversations you have won't be easy conversations to have, like I said, with parents, with teenagers. They're vital conversations to have. They're really important conversations to have. But it's I wouldn't say it burdens you. You must feel somewhat rewarded in terms of being able to talk about it so openly with people who are interested in this story, if they see it reflected in their own lives or their own kids.
So it was always important to us from the outset that we had in-person conversations in communities, not just like put a book out and then tweet about it and Instagram about it, which would seem to defeat the purpose. And so we really tried to go to colleges, certain athletic departments, places that had communities that they felt like there was a good amount of parents who would really benefit from opening up this conversation with their kids. And so we've got a few of those lined up. It's not really a tour. It's just any place that's like, hey, we need this conversation. Can we have it in our community? And we said yes to those places.
You can check out The Trifecta with Spain, Jane, and Kate on ESPN Radio on the weekends. We certainly get it up here, and I hear it pretty frequently on the weekends. The book is called What Made Maddie Run, The Secret Struggles and Tragic Death of an All-American Teen. And, of course, filling for Bob Lee on Between the Lines or E60? Both? Either?
Outside the Lines.
Outside the Lines.
Between, outside, the rest of the ESPN is between the lines. This is outside the lines.
It's amazing what happens to a radio guy when it's not right in front of him.
That's right.
The cue cards disappear and you got to ad lib. Congratulations on the book. It is such a vital, important story. And I really, really enjoyed the conversation. I know others will too. And good luck. And thank you very much for taking the time to do this. We appreciate it. We hope you've enjoyed your brief stay in Canada also. I didn't want to give too much away, but you're in our country right now. And I won't say much more than that.
I am. I love Canada and I grew up near Montreal. So I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan of your country.
Thank you so much for taking the time, Kate. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks a lot. That's that. Our thanks to Kate Fagan for being on. We thank you for listening. You can find us, of course, on iTunes, and you can rate us there. Point taken with Carolyn Cameron and Greg Brady. We wish Carolyn safe travels back from Montreal and Rogers Cup. We'll be back with another edition next week. We get closer to that fall sports season. Take care. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Point Taken with Carolyn Cameron and Greg Brady on Sportsnet.ca/590.